There are many examples given in the Bhagavatam about personalities who leave their homes in pursuit of self-realization. There are many examples. You give some examples. Who can say? Many. Who leave their home, persons who leave their home in pursuit of self-realization. Come on. Yeah, there's so many of them. Parikshit Maharaj, yeah. Dhritarashtra, Bharat Maharaj. What about Dhruva? No, he didn't leave his home in pursuit of self-realization. He wasn't interested in self-realization. He got that as a byproduct. Pandavas, yeah. So there are many examples. So my question is, the question goes on, do we get the karma if we leave our families to take up the practice Krishna consciousness seriously? This is supposed to be edited. These are edited. Not very well. No, not the Queen's English. All right. This is from Bhagavad Gita, chapter 13, text 8 to 12. Purport. It's a long purport. I'll just read the section which is particularly relevant to this question. Srila Prabhupada writes, as for detachment, this is Asakta Anavishvanga Putra Dara Grihadishu. As for detachment from children, wife and home, it is not meant that one should have no feeling for these. They are natural objects of affection. But when they are not favorable to spiritual progress, then one should not be attached to them. The best process for making the home pleasant is Krishna consciousness. If one is in full Krishna consciousness, he can make his home very happy because this process of Krishna consciousness is very easy. One need only chant, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna. Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Accept the remnants of foodstuffs offered to Krishna. Have some discussion on books like Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam and engage oneself in deity worship. These four things will make one happy. One should train the members of his family in this way. The family members can sit down morning and evening and chant together, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. If one can mold his family life in this way to develop Krishna consciousness following these four principles, then there is no need to change from family life to renounced life. But if it is not congenial, not favorable for spiritual advancement, then family life should be abandoned. One must sacrifice everything to realize or serve Krishna, just as Arjuna did. Arjuna did not want to kill his family members, but when he understood that these family members were impediments to his Krishna realization, he accepted the instruction of Krishna and fought and killed them. In all cases, one should be detached from the happiness and distress of family life, because in this world, one can never be fully happy or fully miserable. So there's Srila Prabhupada's clear instruction. However, premature renunciation is also not recommended. Renunciation can be undertaken by people who feel very strongly that they want to get out of family life, but the motive for doing so is more impelled by distress than a positive desire to serve Krishna. And in such a case, where someone renounces home because they find it unattractive, we often find that people who renounce home because they find the situation disagreeable, that after some time they again enter into family situation, again getting married. Or they fall down from the path of renunciation into sex life, because their motive in renouncing was actually, in one sense, for sense gratification. They wanted to be spared from the difficulty that they were in. So that difficulty that can be an incentive to take up spiritual life fully. But if the incentive is largely to just to avoid difficulty, then it's not a strong spiritual platform. Raghunath Das Goswami, when he first wanted to renounce home, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu forbade him to do so. And eventually, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu allowed that. But in the beginning, he didn't allow him to. Later, Raghunath Das became the most austere of the six Goswamis, who are all very austere. So, to renounce a family situation because one finds it undesirable, but if one does not renounce the desire for sense gratification, that's the real thing to be renounced, then he may fall down, or even within a situation of renunciation, supposed to be renunciation, one may arrange for comfortable living, comfortable ashram with all facilities, TV, almost all the ashrams in India, if you see nowadays, they all have TVs, isn't it? You all visit ashrams. It's just considered normal. No one even thinks there's anything wrong with that. And you'll see most sadhus, they have a little bit of something, sadhana in the morning, maybe some arati they attend, or that. Then in the winter, they'll sit in the morning sun about this time of day reading the newspaper. So we might also read the newspaper. Tea and coffee. Well, I didn't even think of that. That's just, when you go to an ashram, they say, chai piyenge, will you drink tea? And in the south, they say, coffee, like that. I wonder what these sannyasis, we have in the Ramanuja Sampradaya, they take sannyas at late in life. They don't have young sannyasis. They're, well, that Chinnajiya Swami, he was an exception. But the general rule in the Ramanuja Sampradaya is that they take sannyas only after they've been through family life, and then they become the GR or something like this. They must be drinking coffee. How can they not do? After all, the South Indian Brahmins are famous for coffee drinking. I don't know. Do they all just give it up? It's not really something we have to investigate, but we should tell them that coffee is going to block your way to Vaikuntha, because there's no, at least we didn't hear of any coffee in Vaikuntha. If you have a desire, you have to come back. You can't offer it to Krishna. So, renunciation is actually a very severe thing. Serious, yeah. And even if one is renouncing for the sake of Krishna consciousness, that has to be seen also. What example that will set to others. If we encourage, for instance, if we encourage young men who are married just to leave their family life, they may do so with all seriousness to serve Krishna, but that will set an example to others who may not be so serious, who will also think, well, so-and-so did it, I'll also do it. So generally, we don't encourage people who have taken the responsibility of family life to just leave that without discharging their responsibility. Responsibility means that they're supposed to have children, then when the children are grown up and settled, then they can renounce. They can either take sannyas or vanaprastha life, husband and wife can together dedicate themselves fully to Krishna consciousness, like Haripada Prabhu is doing now. His children are grown up and he and his wife are fully engaged. Actually, vanaprastha means there may be some touch, so you also have some touch with family like that. Whereas a sannyasi, they're not supposed to even see their children. So we have to see in each case what is suitable. In Vrindavan at Srila Prabhupada's disappearance festival this year, I learned something. I'd never heard of this before. That I remember there was one devotee, Pranav, when I was in Delhi, Vrindavan in 1977. There was one devotee, Pranav. He was an initiated disciple of Srila Prabhupada. He was a Gupta, which, if you're from North India, you know what a Gupta means. It's something like a Chetia here, by caste, a Vaishya, business people. Generally, Guptas are business people. So that's good background. Not that he'd not come to Krishna consciousness because he needed the chapatis. So he and his wife were very helpful in their service because they were stationed in Vrindavan, and at that time the Krishna Balarama, not when I saw Pranav Prabhu. While the temple was being built, it was very difficult for our Western devotees even to stay and live in Vrindavan or anywhere in India, what to speak of organizing the construction and so many other things. So Pranav Prabhu was very helpful. He was late middle age, something like that. So they were very helpful and very service oriented. Pranav Prabhu and his wife were together living in Vrindavan, but Prabhupada was, he would insist, he pressured Pranav that you should live separately from your wife. And Pranav eventually buckled under the pressure, and he couldn't imagine living without his wife. So he withdrew from the service, which was a setback because he was doing so much service. So Manjari, our God sister Manjari. I think she's with Narayan Maharaj camp or something like that. You know, she's from America, by the accent, sounded like. She told us so. Yeah, in the West they pronounce it Manjari, but she's now in Vrindavan. Yeah. Mm. So it was, as she told it, I felt everyone else around me feeling it was almost painful to listen to, because it was almost harsh. So Srila Prabhupada is pushing renunciation there. And he actually, Srila Prabhupada, he gave sannyas to quite a few young men who had wives. I can't think of any case where he gave sannyas to young men who had children, but he did give sannyas to young men. Tamal Krishna being a famous case, Hansa Dutta being another famous case. No, they didn't have. I don't think they had children. I can't think of any case where he gave to those who had children. And someone asked Srila Prabhupada about that. Why are you giving sannyas to young men? And Prabhupada answered, when the vegetable is ready, you cook it. It's ready. Exactly. It's something like Advaita Acharya, what he said to Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. He sent the message to Jagadananda Pandit that there's no need to sell rice in the market anymore. Everyone who wanted rice, they've already bought it. What does that mean? Later it became clear what it meant. So the idea, they're ready for preaching and let them go. But nowadays, we're more cautious in our movement about this, seeing that many took sannyas and fell down. This is being asked by Hari Leela Dasi, by the way. It's not so, her situation is different anyway. I'm talking about renunciation of men. As far as women are concerned, all the bhaktas of North India will praise Mirabai, but no one wants their wife or daughter to be like her. We don't know exactly. I mean, there's a lot of stories which go around, but it's said that in her childhood, she was told by her mother or whatever that the deity of Krishna was her husband. And after that, she didn't want anyone else as her husband. And she was officially married to the Maharana of, what's the place? Bijnor, someplace in Rajasthan. And she never accepted that this is my husband. And then she'd dance in the streets with low-class people. Something like Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was criticized for that also. So, it's not the standard for women to leave. There is the case of Meera, and in our sampradaya we have Ganga Mata Goswamini, who was a princess, daughter of a king. Of course, a king in those days could mean the head of a village also. That's the smallest scale king that there could be. So she left. She came to Vrindavan, and only when it was seen that she was performing severe austerities for some time was she accepted at all, and she was really serious about this. Things are changing. The world is changing. Attitudes are changing. How do we adjust to that? Do we adjust to it? Women do become leaders of nations. So, shouldn't they become temple presidents also? So these are the kind of questions we have to face in our modern movement. Because in the West, there's no distinction in this between men's roles and women's roles. At least they try to make no distinction. As I said, Srila Prabhupada, he made adjustments for the modern age, but he also made it clear what direction he wanted the movement to go in. Toward traditional roles as given in Shastra. So it's already not an easy task to try to induce people to chant Hare Krishna and give up a life of sense gratification and four regulated principles. But on top of that, we have a whole culture which, according to modern ideas, is oppressive, antiquated. We have to introduce this also. Of course, We don't consider it oppressive or antiquated, but that's what people think. So we have to bring that in also. It's not an easy job. But there can be no real human civilization unless there's there are many factors, but one of them is there should be a clear demarcation in the social roles of men and women. In industrialized society, it doesn't matter so much. Everything's done by machine. But even then, there are some things which require stronger bodies. For instance, firefighting. For the sake of gender equality, women are now in the fire brigade. Not yet in India, I don't think. But that means that their effectiveness in fighting fires is compromised because women in general don't have the same physical capacity as men do. So, that's another topic altogether. Okay. All right, Hare Krishna. Those questions finished. Anything else? Questions, comments? Yeah, all right, yeah. Bahulashwar, our god brother. Where is he? I'm trying to remember him if I know him. I'm just trying to think of if I know him. Okay, Bahulashwar.
I want to take sannyas, his family life is difficult. And Prabhupada wrote him back and said, you do not need a pole to preach. Go on preaching, you don't require a pole. In other words, stay in your family life and preach as it is.
Jai, I think that letter is not in the Veda base. I don't remember that. It would have been quite a famous letter if it had reached the Veda base.
Some are not printed in the Veda base yet, but they
may make it to the Veda base yet. And many of Prabhupada's letters also are no longer existent. There may be many instructions also, which are verbal instructions, which... Last time I spoke to Ravindra Swarup Prabhu, which was in 2012 in Philadelphia, he told me that, well, let's go back first of all. We know that from the conversations that when Nitai arranged for the Radha Krishna deities, Radha, Shamasundra and Vrindavan, for the big forms of the deities to be bathed, the Abhishek in public on some festival day, Srila Prabhupada was very disapproving of that. He said the big deity should never be moved. So Ravindra Swarup told me that he wanted to take the deities of Radha Krishna, Radha Sharad Bihari, I believe they're called in Philadelphia. They're not so big. They're maybe about 3 feet, 3.5 feet high, approximately. Krishna's a little taller than Radha, as usual. He wanted to take them on a rat around the city, have a festival and take them out. But the ISKCON deity minister told him, you can't do that. But he told me that Srila Prabhupada himself had told him to do that. But it's not recorded, so it's lost to history. So there may be many such instructions. Why Srila Prabhupada would have said that when he said not even to bring the deities out for bathing? Well, that's difficult to understand, but I don't think that Ravindra was lying to me. I'm sure Prabhupada did say that, but it's not the standard thing to do. It's common thing to, that the deities come out of the temple and go around on a rat or a palki or whatever. Palki means palanquin. But not, there are different deities for that. The Utsav deities, they're taken outside. Not the usually big deities are not moved. And in temples in South India, you couldn't move them anyway. They're too big.
Mm. I have a question, Maharaj, about the point you made that there's pressure for us in ISKCON to accept some of the new customs that people are practicing in life now.
Mm.
In other words, cultures have changed and they become much more liberalized with mixing of men and women. But it certainly seems to me like all of the changes have been simply for facilitation of more sense balance.
Yeah.
So how can we,
do we have to adjust ISKCON to the modern world? It's a great question. We have, in America they talk about culture wars, which is basically between the Christian right, which is a large lobby, strongly behind the Republican Party, and there is the rest, the modern liberal outlook.
Liberal loons,
they're called, from the right hand. From the right. Right wing and left wing, these are modern socio-political, ideological constructs which don't belong to the Vedic culture. Vedic culture is that we follow Guru, Sadhu and Shastra. So yeah, you made the point that these modern liberalism, mixing of men and women, and then you get same-sex marriages and all things like that. Abortion, it's all allowed, contraception. These ideas have all come in due to it's facilitating sense gratification. So why should our movement adjust to that? That's the question. It is a great question, and I'm on the same side of the fence as you on this question. The moral minority. They used to talk about the moral majority, but now I think it's the moral minority in America also. But the argument is given that, well, it's just so difficult for people to adjust themselves to mentally. That why force that on them? Women can do the job of temple president just as well. Well, why not? Well, I say why not because women have a specific role in society and we should start to preach that by practice, show that by practice. But it is a... it is a point of contention because I would take that as largely speaking true, that many people in the modern West, due to the culture they've been raised in, the education they have, consider that any attempt to restrict women from having any role that men have is what they call sexism, and it's just something which is bigoted and seriously wrong. It comes from a wicked mentality. That's what they're trained to think. And it's just an assumption of the modern culture. I started to listen to a series of university lectures on world history, and it's amazing how judgmental they are, because they see everything through. It's like Marx, he saw the whole of history in terms of class struggle. And this professor, who's a male, who I'm listening to his lectures, he sees gender struggle as the dominant feature of human history. And they judge civilizations on how much they give facility to women. So it's strongly pervasive in our society. But then in other, if we want to make our society very liberal like that, with the idea that it will appeal to Western people, well, it immediately disqualifies us from appealing to the Muslim world. So if you want to you adjust to one civilization, and then you become disadjusted with another civilization. So I feel it's better to stick to our principles. We don't have to ram them down the throat the first time anyone comes to our center and say that, you know, if you don't accept this immediately, then there's no chance. But it has to be introduced. And anyone who's at all serious about spiritual life or even moral religious life can understand that there should be separation between men and women. In the churches, I don't know about now, but it used to be that the men and women would be on different sides of the church. Even now, in 2012, I came from America to Kuwait. My next stop after America was Kuwait. And at a public program, Kuwait, you don't do public, you don't go out in the streets, but in a program in a school in which people were invited, almost all Indians, with a few Filipinos came also, then the men and women naturally sat on different sides. And I noted that, and I said, I just came from America, where you feel constrained even to ask them to sit in separate places, because that's another part of the culture. They don't want to accept any authority, and they don't want to have anything imposed on them. So if you ask them some simple thing like, can the men and women sit separately, you're afraid that there might be some protest and they'll throw you out. In ISKCON Helsinki, the men and women sit separately, and Scandinavia's got to be most liberal place in the world. Feminism is the national culture of Sweden in particular. But it's instituted there in the temple because of the temple leader, who is very clear about these matters. Women join, they join the temple. There's this idea that no intelligent woman will want to join our movement, but they don't. Some of them want to be protected and have a sane kind of life. Yeah, and this is a huge topic. Once we get started on this, there's no end to it.
The point, Maharaj, I believe, is when society takes sense gratification, gratifying your senses is the goal of life, then whatever our restrictions just make no common sense at all to them.
Yeah, it doesn't,
That's why they're
they can't understand it at all. Yeah. So we have to explain from the very beginning. Why are we doing like this? Because we have a completely different understanding of life and a completely different goal of life. Yeah. That point you made, that modern society is based on pravritti marg, is not exactly technically correct. It's based on vikarma. Pravritti marg means the Vedic path of sense gratification, in which there are restrictions such as separate gender roles. It's actually a Vedic path. But the modern society is based on, there's no philosophy, just animalism, actually. Sophisticated animalism. And even some animals, they cooperate with each other better than humans do. Like ants, bees, dolphins, crows. I just listened to two or three lectures in this world history. So there are so many assumptions which they just the whole description of Neolithic man, and then how we evolved, and then man is by nature violent. That's because they're violent. In the Western world, they have a violent culture, but it's not that people in general are violent. It's a lot to do with culture. He just says it as if it's a fact. They say all these things, as if they just presume and... Yeah. So many assumptions built into that. That's why I by listening to this, I can understand more clearly why university education is extremely contaminating. Because sometimes devotees say, well, if you just study something like computer science, it doesn't matter because it's non-ideological. If you study something like gender studies, which means feminism, or history. Even history is totally Marxist feminist, or something which has ideology built into it. Then that's very dangerous. But somebody says, well, it's all right if you study something like mathematics or computer programming or something like that. But the whole association is one of sense gratification and the idea that we're here to enjoy the world, and we all descended from ultimately from cells, and then there was some prototype ancestor of monkeys and humans. Gross speculation. But they just talk as if it is a fact. It's an axiom. It's not to be questioned. They say, well, science shows that we all descended from simple cells. If you ask any of them, how do you know? How do you know? They say, well, scientists, they say. They have faith in the scientists. Scientists can't prove it. I was just discussing that the other day. They want to say that they can explain how things, from what we see today, they can explain what it was like in the distant past. By studying the effect, you can understand the cause. So my answer to that is, okay, without any prior knowledge, if you see a butterfly, how would you conclude it came from a caterpillar? Or a bird came from an egg? How would you say? And you made that point, that's a very good point. If you landed in the Sahara Desert, for instance, which wasn't a desert, it used to be rich agricultural land until recently. If you land in the Sahara Desert and then you went off to your spaceship and you went back to your planet, you might say, well, the Earth is just full of sand, that's all. So we see a tiny part of the universe and we presume that it's all like that. It's not a logical presumption. There are so many axioms that you have to accept in science to do science. For instance, that the laws of nature that we have ascertained are universally applicable. It's not provable, either theoretically or practically. Hare Krishna. Another question. I was going to say, according to the Pavlov's law, You should all be ready for prasadam. Yeah. Who what? Who spans more than one of those categories?
Yes. Who maybe in private may be critical of other devotees and offensive in his mind, but in another way he's benevolent and he speaks nicely and helpfully toward some other devotees. So how is one's how should one have an attitude? What kind of an attitude should one have toward a devotee who seems to be, you know, not clearly categorized with one of those categories?
Yeah, well, that's following the verse, Ishvare Tadadhinayeshu Bali Seishu Dvishatshucha Prema Maitri Kripa Upeksha Yakaroti Samadhyama. A Madhyamadhikari, devotee is one who loves God, befriends devotees, is compassionate to the foolish and avoids the envious. So the question is, if we see a devotee who is nice to some devotees and not nice to others, who is not fully in that category, how do we categorize? Should we, when we said we should make friends with devotees, what does it mean? Yeah, well, this is obviously a very simple, broad categorization, and there's more instruction given on this. There is the, what is that? Svato Snigdasya, what is that? We should associate with devotees of the same outlook, and we should... Well, that's there in the Upadeshamrita, isn't it? That the Krishneti yasya giritam manasadriyeta jikshasta yat pranatibhischa bhajantam isham. Then, sushrushaya. There we go. My Kali Yuga brain again. Bhajana vigyam ananya. Ananya something. Train the Gurukul boys. They can have a better chance than me. Nindadi shunya. Ipsita sangha labdhya. You left out some words also. Nindadi shunya ipsita sangha labdhya. Yeah, one should, among devotees, one should mentally respect one. Krishneti yasya giritam manas. One should mentally respect one who chants the name of Krishna. One should offer visible respect. One should bow down to one who is initiated. And one should faithfully hear from and serve one who is a pure devotee, who is fully absorbed in service to Krishna, and who is himself free from the tendency to criticize others. So that brings us up to the question of criticizing others. But then we see Srila Prabhupada criticized others. Krishna criticizes others. This is discussed in detail in this book on speaking strongly in Srila Prabhupada's service. We are forced to make some criticism for the sake of rectification of Vaishnava society. Otherwise, if we say, see no evil, hear no evil, speak no evil, then evil will flourish. given the chance. So we have to speak. But Bhaktivinoda Thakur, as I quoted in that book, he's given some conditions on which one should criticize, that one's intention should be to, for the benefit of the person criticized and of the Vaishnava society. And there are some other conditions he gives. So this idea that no one should ever criticize at any time, that in itself is a criticism of those who do. It's an idea which is floated around by Sahajiyas and Mayavadis, although they themselves are usually very critical of other Sahajiyas and Mayavadis. If you want to go to Radha Kund among all the pure Babajis, you'll find they hate each other, mostly. They're very envious of each other. So we're told. I don't have anything to do with them, but I've heard this. Then again, in Chaitanya Bhagavat, Vrindavan Das warns us again and again, if we see two Vaishnavas quarreling, we should not take sides. So it's a nuanced subject. We can understand this well if we ourselves are saragrahi, if we are interested in the essence, which is pure surrender to Krishna, and we're not on the superficial platform of being so-called nice. We may think, well, we want to make people happy. The Krishna consciousness means we want to make people happy. So, if we open schools so that children can get a good job and open hospitals so that they can get fit for sense gratification and have eye camps so they can watch television, then everyone will be happy. And only envious people criticize such things. But making people happy on the material platform is not the task of a sadhu. So, everyone will be happy, but some within one's own movement may criticize that. That why have you, why are you promoting that which people in their delusion they like, instead of giving that which will smash their illusion? Bhakti can only be communicated by bhakti, by any amount of karma, jnana and yoga. Bhakti will never be awakened. Even if you open 10 million hospitals, that in itself won't do anything for promoting pure devotional service. Of course, you could say that, well, you can open a hospital and preach, people come to the hospital. But our acharya's process is to open a temple, not a hospital. That's our acharya's process. Anyway, Hare Krishna. It's time for feeding the school children and everyone else. All glories to His Divine Grace, Srila Prabhupada. Hare Krishna. Dicheti yasya pranati vishchata jantavishya.